Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Each cancer, whether we're talking about breast cancer, colon cancer, or leukemia, is a different disease with many different causes, many different treatments, and different prognoses. As you age, the risk for many cancers can increase, and this is due to a combination of random mutations occurring in our genetic instructions, which gets reproduced millions of times daily, and that interacts with certain environmental influences to lead to increased risk over time. However, one cancer, cervical cancer, is now known to be caused by a virus, the human papillomavirus. And we now have, because of this, a safe way to prevent each of us from getting this infection, making cervical cancer perhaps the most preventable cancer affecting humans. In fact, the CDC has recently estimated that 93% of cervical cancers are preventable. Our guests today are Shiloh Small. She's a physician, an OBGYN specialist with South Central Foundation. She's a member of the Northern Cheyenne Tribe. She was raised in Montana. She earned a medical degree at the University of South Dakota and then did her OBGYN residency at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Also in the studio with Dr. Small and myself is Abby Struthert. Abby's a health systems manager with the American Cancer Society. She is an Alaskan, got a graduate or her undergraduate degree at Purdue University. And now that she's with American Cancer Society, her primary focus is cancer prevention and access to care. She's focused particularly on HPV, that's human papillomavirus vaccinations, colorectal cancer, breast cancer, and tobacco cessation. Thanks to each of you for coming. I think it's the first time for both of you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It's nice to have you here. And let me remind listeners, if you have questions or comments on what you hear today, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And we have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Small, I'm going to start with you and ask you to tell me when you think of or conjure up in your mind cervical cancer, what are you thinking about? What is it all about?
Well, like you said, it is highly preventable with the vaccine, the HPV vaccine. I'm thinking that with screening and prevention, we have been able to decrease the numbers of cervical cancer during the last 30 years or so. So when someone comes to see me, I think just getting that information to them is important.
And who's at risk? What's the epidemiology? This is primarily, obviously, a female disease. We'll talk about how males get involved in the epidemiology. Sure. But what's the age group? What's the lifestyle? What's the individual who gets cervical cancer all about?
So the HPV vaccine is fairly ubiquitous in women that are young, sexually active, immunocompromised individuals with HIV, for instance, are at higher risk for cervical cancer. Smokers, definitely. The HPV virus loves women that smoke. So those are some of the risk factors.
Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes as people are listening, they think smoking may be a cause of cervical cancer. When you say what you just said, my mind goes is, well, maybe people who smoke are perhaps more likely to drink also. If you're more likely to drink, you're likely maybe to have more sexual partners. So it's an associated factor, not necessarily the cause.
Sure, that could
make sense. Is that the way you think about it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Abby, you're educating people about this stuff. Do you think people have a good understanding of cervical cancer cause?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an understanding there, but I think what we're trying to tackle really is understanding what HPV vaccination is, mm-hmm. and that it's cancer prevention. Mm-hmm. And we're really trying to move away from the sexual connotation, mm-hmm. Really trying to get away from the transmission piece altogether and really just look at the vaccine as cancer prevention, mm-hmm. reducing HPV-related cancers.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to, we'll probably come back to that. Another, what you said, it makes me think about we're learning how to frame these issues so people pay more attention. As humans are social animals, and we really pay attention to stories more, and we don't want to hear all the facts necessarily. We don't respond to that as well. And I think I heard a little bit of that about what you were saying, but we'll come back to that in a little bit. So you mentioned, Dr. Small, that the incidence, I think you said, was decreasing a little bit. So I have a fact in front of me that from the CDC has noticed that about a little over 1% a year for the last, well, between 2003 and 2012, about 1% per year is decreased. That's a pretty significant decrease in the incidence.
Yeah. The American College of OBGYNs quotes that there's been a 50% decrease in the last 30 years, so that's huge.
Yeah.
And they attribute that to screening and prevention, so it's huge.
And then mortality also has decreased, it appears. And the reasons for that would be?
Well, I think that, like what Abby was mentioning, we need to be thinking about the vaccine as being cancer prevention.
And we also, I guess, mortality might be decreased because of some of the messages that got across to women to get pap smears and get evaluated. Mm-hmm. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. And when I talk to women, I think about, if you think about a virus and any type of virus, whether it be influenza or if we think about our immune systems and just trying to make sure that we're healthy, getting enough sleep, not being stressed, which is hard to do sometimes, but also not smoking because the virus really does kind of like to be around when you're stressed and stressing your body in those ways.
Right. So we mentioned that HPV, a human papillomavirus, is the cause. Let's talk about the human papillomavirus just a little bit. You used the word ubiquitous. What do you mean?
Well, I think that a lot of us are exposed to this virus and that there's many different types of HPV virus types, and some of the high-risk types are what we're worried about for causing cervical cancer. I think we can be exposed to those mostly through, it's mostly sexually transmitted. And I think we can decrease our risk by limiting sexual partners, using condoms, things like that that we've all heard about. But that's something that it's out there and a lot of people have it and don't even know that they have it.
How do you explain the HPV being so common to people you talk to, Abby?
Well, I think it's important to think about the word infection.
Mm-hmm.
It is an infection, and it's widespread. From the American Cancer Society, about 8 out of 10 individuals will come across the HPV infection in their lifetime. And for the most part, thankfully, I think that your body can cure it on its own, but in some of those cases it turns into cancer, so it needs to be taken seriously regardless.
Right. One way I have helped people understand the idea of ubiquitous, meaning it's just there all the time, is that many of the strains, and there's something like over 150 that physicians have very cleverly named 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, up through 150. Many of those strains are just causes of common warts. And as a pediatrician, you realize pretty quickly, also maybe if you're a parent, that kids get warts pretty commonly. And often they ask, well, how did I get this, or how did my child get this wart? But the fact is, it's one of those things we're getting exposed to all the time. HPV, however, the way I try to explain, I want you guys to change my mind or make sure I'm telling people right. Certain ones, particularly number 16 and number 18, have this, what we would call in medicine, oncogenic potential, the ability to cause cancer. We don't know why it causes cancer in all women, so that's, as you implied, Abby, as I understand it, some women, many women, may get even HPV number 16 and 18 and never get cancer. But of all women who have cervical cancer, they all have number 16 and 18. So there's something going on in those women, and the ideal way to prevent that would be to prevent them from getting infection in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And they get that infection by?
Well, it's a sexually transmitted infection.
Okay.
I talk about with my patients, we talk about doing screening, which is a form of a pap smear. Mm-hmm. So it comes back either low grade or high grade, and that really correlates to the types of virus that they have, whether it be low risk type that causes genital warts or the high risk that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing to what's important about that is if you have a high risk type, we think about 10 years for that to turn into a cervical cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So that gives us time to screen and prevent this. And I think that the times that I see the worst cervical cancer or the worst outcomes are the women that don't have access to care, that haven't had any pap smear screening ever. And they're the ones that are coming in with these cancers that could have been prevented.
Mm-hmm. And you've implied, and we may have to get into this again later, is that for a long period of time from the onset of infection through some kind of sexual activity that you don't know you're getting that infection, the potential for cancer has been set up, and it may take years for that to really manifest itself. So the advantage of continuing to be checked to see mm-hmm. if there are changes. If you wait too long, and then those individuals may come into you, and it's really in a much different stage, much more difficult to treat.
Yeah.
So, Abby, you'd mentioned, I think, that you don't like to talk about the sexual aspects of this. However, it is a close personal contact kind of transmission. And women primarily are going to get it from men, and that's why men are also vaccinated. And we want to provide immunity against this virus before you become sexually active. So the recommendations now are for the vaccine to be given at 9, 10, 11, 12 years of age, and that sometimes causes some concern. That's where I thought maybe the American Cancer Society, many people who talk about these vaccines are a little bit hesitant to talk about that aspect of prevention because it seems like it might be encouraging kids to have sex earlier.
Yeah, that's definitely a concern. Being a mom myself to a daughter, I look at it differently now. I can see where it would be concerning to a parent. They're so young, but it's cancer prevention. If you're able to give your child something to prevent a disease that could, could kill them, right, would you do it? And they're, really just looking at the research, it's showing the 11 and 12, their immune system is, taking this vaccine like a champ at that stage. And that's why it's so important before their 13th birthday to get that done. It's just showing the best efficacy or at that stage and age.
And the other thing you want to do is before they become sexually active. And then studies have actually been done to see if giving the vaccine encourages boys and girls to be more promiscuous. And I know the answer to that question. What do you guys know about the answer to that question?
Well, I think it's crazy to think that our kids aren't smart. They're very smart. And if we aren't giving them the tools and the information, that's kind of our bad. We need to be thinking that, sexual education does not cause promiscuity.
Right.
And talking to our kids about this vaccine, I have an 18-year-old and a 14-year-old. They both have the vaccine. And when we spoke about it, they are a lot smarter than we give them credit for.
Right.
So we need to be not withholding information, but actually giving them information.
Yeah, and if they don't get good information, often the information they get is not so reliable, is what I've found.
Yes, I agree with that.
And that gets to the quality of information that kids can find very ubiquitously on the Internet. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is cervical cancer. My guests are Dr. Shiloh Small of the South Central Foundation and Abby Strufford with the American Cancer Society. If you've got questions or comments, we encourage you to call and see if you can get your questions and comments clarified. Our local number again, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1, you have to spell that out, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be here for the next 45 minutes or so. If you've got questions, this would be the best time to give us a call. Another question that comes up anytime we talk about vaccinations is this emotional concern about, you know, is it encouraging sexual activity, which we've talked about. The other big one is fear of consequences of the vaccine. What should we say about that?
Well, I think it's important to remember that it's the HPV vaccine isn't like this fresh new vaccine. We're 10 years into it now. It came out a year after the meningococcal. It's showing great research as far as, or great data as far as, you know, no severe reactions to the vaccine. So I think it's important to look at the research and understand that it's not this necessarily new vaccine that it's looked at in some ways as.
Dr. Small?
Well, I think the vaccine's very safe, and we have the numbers to show that now. And I think that you know, there are some side effects people can get, and they're usually very minimal. The most common would be pain at the site of the injection. You know, your arm can get sore. You can have some mild, you know, fever, headache. Those would be the most common, but they're, again, not very common either. So I think that the risks to getting the vaccine, you know, very much outweigh the benefit of what we can, you know, what we can think about with cervical cancer, other types of cancers, and preventing that. I think the vaccine is, it's a no-brainer to get this vaccine.
Yeah, a lot of people might worry. There's nothing contagious in it. There's no live virus in this vaccine, so you're not going to get any illness. And one of the tenets of healthcare is never give a treatment of any sort that's going to be worse than the illness itself. And so this information is collated. There's lots of studies that go on with hundreds of thousands of people before the vaccine gets licensed, and then there's ongoing studies afterwards. Unfortunately, people see all kinds of things on the internet, which has very little validity. I would point out to people they really want to pay close attention to the information they see that show that this vaccine is dangerous. This is probably one of our safest and most effective vaccines, and we're clearly seeing a marked decrease in the incidence of cervical cancer, partly in response to this vaccine, which we've seen with all vaccine-preventable illnesses. We have a caller. Let's see. Marilyn, you're on line one.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can. What can we do for you?
Well, my question was, why do I no longer get a pap smear after, I don't know what age it was, that they, you know, they don't think we can get cervical cancer? I don't know.
Ah,
is that
so
why? Thought, why don't we?
Yes, I thought there was going to be two questions.
Anymore.
Why don't older women, we haven't actually talked about the age that is recommendation for the vaccine, so I'll come back to that because that's not exactly what you asked. What's the recommendations for pap smears, Dr. Small?
So they've changed over the years with the new research that we've had, and so we used to give pap smears to women as soon as they were sexually active. But we know that now we start at age 21 through age 65, and that's because of just of how the virus works. It was very common, like we talked about, and young women are exposed at a higher rate. The consensus was that we were doing lots of unnecessary procedures on young women that would have otherwise cleared the virus on their own, and so starting at 21 and screening until 65, and that's based on the fact that if you've had no abnormal pap smears, if you've had abnormal pap smears or precancerous lesions on your cervix, we're going to be screening even after 65.
I don't think I was ever asked that by my current doctor, who is a, like totally new doctor because mm-hmm. I was on Medicare now, and my doctor, you know, didn't take Medicare patients. I don't think I was ever asked that, and I did have one abnormal one, but it might have been an error. I don't know.
Right.
Because when I did it over again, it was normal.
Sure. So if you think of the Pap smear as a screening, it just it's a brushing of the cervix. You look at the cells, send those to the pathologist, and they're going to tell you whether you need to get a larger biopsy of the cervix. And when that shows abnormalities, if you actually have a higher grade lesion on the cervix, that's when we are going to be screening you long term. That might be the confusion there.
So if she had a significant abnormality on a previous one, it would have been recommended to have more testing.
She would have had a biopsy and yes.
So I assume you are over, what was the age, 62?
65.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm going to be 68 in a few months. Mm-hmm.
So your risk of having significant disease from HPV after 65 is much less likely. I mean, this gets into this algorithm we play with all the time, you're not as likely to have any significant consequences due to your life expectancy after a certain age, so that doing that test may find some false positives that end up leading to some other particular problems. So the risk-benefit ratio changes. I'm not explaining that as clearly.
Well,
but
I think especially for you, you've not had a history of having any high-grade lesions or biopsies that have been that we've been following, so you fall into the lower risk category. So, mm-hmm.
okay,
yeah,
not. As I think about it, I might have had a biopsy mm-hmm. a long time ago, but you would think that would be in my record, and then people would be aware of all that.
And it sounds like you've also had subsequent Pap smears that have been fine.
Oh, yes, many, many.
And so that makes your likelihood of any serious risk pretty darn low.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's good to know.
Okie doke.
Thank you kindly.
All righty. Thanks for your call. Remind listeners again, if you have questions or comments similar to Marilyn's, you can reach us by calling 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. To continue this discussion about the vaccines, we've talked about the vaccine being recommended very early in childhood, particularly around 9, 10, 11, 12, when the immune system seems to respond very nicely and better than it may later. Plus, we want to have individuals protected before they become at risk, and their biggest risk factor is beginning to have sexual activity. What is the age that we stop recommending it, and why is it stopped recommending at that age? Our ages.
Yeah, that the age for women is age 26, and the age for men is age 21. Mm-hmm. From what I understand, it's I hope I'm saying this right, but a limitation due to research. Mm-hmm. I think there's interest in looking beyond that.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the way I would think about it, and Dr. Small, is, again, it's not recommended. At first, it wasn't recommended for boys because even though there's no reason to think it wouldn't be successful, we didn't know. The evidence wasn't there that it was safe and effective. So we don't have thousands of people that are older than that that it's been shown to be safe and effective. There's very little reason to think it's not. However, the older you get, the more likely you're going to be sexually active. The more likely you're sexually active, the more likely you already have been exposed, and the less likely the vaccine will be helpful. Mm-hmm. True?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I tell my patients, I've had that question come up, and that's exactly it. I tell them, you know, these vaccines have to be FDA approved, and studies have limitations as well. And so I think that was the age that was set, and for both those reasons you mentioned.
All right. Is there any harm to give a vaccine to someone older than, let's say, 26?
I don't think so, no. I mean, we know that this vaccine's safe.
Right. Right. Yeah, I have some older girls, and the question came up. And there is possible to find out whether you have had an HPV infection to serotypes 16 and 18 with some blood tests.
Yeah.
So if you were so inclined and you were 28 and you wanted to know, would the vaccine particularly help you? You could find out by just a blood test to see if you've had those infections. Is that generally
So the recommendation is when we do the pap smear under age 30, we aren't reflexing those to look at the HPV if you have the virus. But after age 30, we're reflexing and seeing if that HPV virus is there or is high risk, and that kind of tells us is this virus, you know, when you get exposed to the virus, if your body usually clears it in the first year, and if it's staying around and if it's high risk, those are the people we're going to be watching. So there's very specific algorithms to follow.
Right. Getting back to warts, most warts disappear no matter what you do. That's why frogs have been associated with and all kinds of things making them go away. So the same thing is true of HPV number 16 and 18. For many people who get infected, they get rid of it. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, some people don't. And we don't know how to predict who those people are, so they're better off getting the vaccine to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. Melinda, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey, I had a question about after you get a precancerous diagnosis, I underwent a procedure called the LEAP procedure. Don't really understand what it was, but after you have that done, I guess they remove precancerous cells. Do you need to go back on a more aggressive screening regimen or a regular screening regimen? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, good question.
So a LEAP procedure is a larger biopsy, and it can be a form of finding out more information or a form of treatment. The HPV vaccine likes the transition zone on the cervix, which is the area where the LEAP is taken care of or removed. So a lot of times, depending on what that LEAP shows, we can kind of cure what the precancer cells, where they were and what they were doing to the cervix. So depending on what that LEAP shows, we guide our screening based on that. And a lot of times it's, if the margins were clear, it's, you know, you go to yearly and then every 3 years and then every 5 years pap smear. So that it just depends on what your LEAP showed.
Okay. All right. If that didn't answer all your questions, Melinda, please give us a call back. Right now, we're reminding listeners once again that you're listening to Line 1, your health connection, our local number 550-8433. The toll-free number 1-888-353-5752 and our email address line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a one-minute break and then we'll continue this discussion on cervical cancer with Dr. Shiloh Small of South Central Foundation and Abby Struthert of the American Cancer Society. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about cervical cancer. We're talking about the causes, the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of this uniquely preventable cancer. I say uniquely preventable. Hopefully you've been listening and you understand why we can say that. Our guests are Abby Struffert with the American Cancer Society and Dr. Shiloh Small, an OBGYN specialist with South Central Foundation. You can email your questions to us over the next 25 or 30 minutes at line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally, 550-8433. Also, you can call us with a toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And remember, as always, if you're listening between 8 and 9 p.m. on Monday evenings, you're listening to a taped recording, and we will not be available to answer calls or emails from that program. Abby, tell us a little bit more about the American Cancer Society and the programs and services you've got out there, and then kind of what you're doing to help increase awareness about cervical cancer and HPV and vaccines in particular.
Sure. So let me just kind of break down the cancer control program, or I guess department, that we have with the American Cancer Society. So in each state, we have a few different positions. One is a mission delivery position, and that position is going to oversee the programs and services that we have locally. These programs are really focused on those that have a cancer diagnosis and really need support to get to and through treatment. So whether that's transportation, lodging, look good, feel better classes to help with just physical and emotional impact of cancer. Then we also have a hospital systems position, and that position is really to work with the cancer providers across the state, connecting them to the American Cancer Society, kind of acting as a liaison between any sort of medical personnel that would come across a cancer patient in their journey, and making sure they're educated on what we're here to do and how we can help. And then we have the state and primary care side, and that's the position that I oversee here in our state. And we're really focused on joining hands with one, kind of the cancer control folks in the state, and that grant is run by Julia Thorsness here locally, and then Judith Muller on the tribal side. So I work closely with them, kind of sit in on coalitions, and then also on the primary care side is providing support to federally qualified health centers. So really reaching out to that primary care, the primary care clinics, specifically those that see patients that are underserved or uninsured.
Okay. And you had mentioned to me in an email before you came that it's kind of this HPV vaccination education is an awareness is really a top priority. Why is that?
Well, just the simple fact that we can reduce a type of cancer, reduce an HPV-related cancer. We used to use the word eliminate. That's a little bit too too much. So we're going back to the word reducing. So it's just a top priority for cancer control to increase vaccination rates. In fact, we have some CDC funding that's created the HPV Vax Group, and they're working on putting together roundtables and different efforts across the nation to raise awareness, raise education, support our primary care folks, and really just increase the vaccination rates across our whole nation.
Okay. Got an email I want to address, and then we have a caller, and then we'll kind of move on maybe to symptoms and treatment issues. This email says, after a woman tests positive for a high-risk subtype of HPV, we've mentioned 16 and 18. There are some other subtypes, but the principal bad guys seem to be this subtype 16 and 18. After a woman tests positive for those, how often should she have a pap smear is the question.
Well, it depends on the age and also what the pap smear, the screening shows. So you can have the vaccine, but your body can be doing a good job at clearing it. But the body can be doing a good job at clearing it. So it depends on what that pap smear shows. So if you have a high-risk pap smear high-grade pap smear with a high-risk oncotype of the virus, then you would need to have probably a LEAP or a larger biopsy procedure, and it'd just be based on that. There are algorithms that are followed, so it would be what specifically your pap smear showed that would guide us.
All right, so the pap smear increases, tells you if there's a significant risk, you may have the infection, but you may never go ahead. You may go ahead and clear that. So the second part of this email says, what if a woman has a normal pap smear but has a positive test for HPV? Let's say we know she's got the evidence of infection with the two subtypes. Does this change the recommendation? So with a normal pap smear, what would happen in a person known to be infected?
With a normal pap smear and a high-risk HPV, like a 16 or 18, the recommendation would be either repeating co-testing in a year, which would mean a repeat pap smear with a repeat HPV screen, or going forward and doing a colposcopy, which is a procedure that's using a colposcope, which is like a microscope looking at the cervix and looking for any lesions and taking a biopsy. So it either one is acceptable.
And the reason for the ability to take your time here is because we know the natural history for most cervical cancers is extended periods of time, and we can kind of see those changes evolving. So you don't have to be too aggressive for most women.
That's true.
Well, let me ask another question, since this is an area I have no idea about.
Sure.
We are definitely learning, and I've said at the beginning of the program, there are definitely differences in how cancers, each different cancer can behave. But it's also true, is my understanding, for prostate cancer, breast cancer, each of these can also behave differently. So there might be very aggressive cervical cancers, I'm guessing.
Oh, yes, definitely. And we don't know why different HPV types affect women in different ways. So I think that, you know, continued screening is helpful so that we aren't, like I said, it would be rare for a woman to come in with cervical cancer that hasn't been getting routine screening recommended.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Sandy, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hey there. I have a question about vaccinations and then still testing positive for HPV 16 and 18. This is a personal case. I was vaccinated in 2003 at age 17 prior to ever becoming sexually active. And then my most recent pap smear showed that I have both HPV 16 and 18. So does that mean that I was exposed to the virus prior to the vaccination?
Right.
Or what?
Was,
any idea there?
Yeah, or was there a vaccine failure, for example? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
All right, Dr. Small, Abby, you guys want to handle that one?
Well, I think Abby had mentioned where we were talking about we are going to eradicate or just reduce. And I don't think the vaccine is 100% effective. I think it's highly effective, but maybe perhaps in your case, your immune system didn't respond. But it's really hard to say.
You got vaccinated at age 17, so I assume you got one of the older vaccines and the initial ones that came out, and you should have gotten three doses. Is that correct?
It was the Gardasil three-dose series.
Yeah. So the newer vaccine we've been or the newer sequence of is two doses if you're less than 15 years of age and you've completed it. Just that's another thing we haven't talked about. So one of the reasons for doing early is you can get done early. You can get completed with not having to have the third one. But in your case, you did get the three vaccines. Sounds like you got it appropriately. I have seen studies, then this is a difficult study, kind of study to verify, with girls who say, I have never been sexually active, and they are positive for HPV 16 and 18. So the question then becomes, one, how do you define sexual activity? Two, can a girl transmit that personally by your own hygiene? For example, these viruses are everywhere. So, and then another one, as Dr. Small has suggested, is there is no 100% effective vaccine. There probably never
Correct.
Will be. So those mm-hmm. are potential answers to that question for you that I can come up
okay.
with. All right?
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have one more caller that just came in before we move on. Steve, you're on line one?
Yes. Good afternoon. I had a question about some of the statistics you provided about incidence of cervical cancer. I believe I understood that the ladies indicated that over the last several decades there's been a 30% decrease in the incidence of cervical cancer. But in the last few years, it's only been 1% per year.
In
my mind, that doesn't
change.
It sounds like the vaccine is less effective.
Yeah, Steve, you're paying attention. I think Dr. Small, I'm going to ask her to correct, but she said that the OB Society American College of Obesity says that it's decreased 50% in the last 20 or 30 years. In the incidence I was quoting between 2003 and 2012, it was 1.3% per year, which would be about a 10% in a 10-year period of time. So I don't have the information that Dr. Small was saying, but she was talking about a slightly different, a longer period of time, too.
30 years was that was quoted. It's not, we haven't had the vaccine for that long, but that was more of the prevention with the screening pap smears also.
Okay.
Okay, I'm not sure that answers the question because the stats still don't, but I will hang up and listen further.
Okay. Thanks for your call. All right. Let's talk about symptoms. All right, so a woman maybe even thinks she's done everything right. Regardless, what kind of symptoms would bring her to you, assuming perhaps that she has not done any pap smears, hasn't been getting regular care?
Sure. There can be pain, pelvic pain, abnormal discharge, spotting after intercourse. Those are some of the things I can think of off the top of my head.
Bleeding?
Yeah, I mean, you can have bleeding, irregular bleeding, pain, yeah. And also, a big one is the postcoital or after intercourse spotting.
Mm-hmm. How about symptoms of HPV infection? Would a woman know that she's had an infection? We maybe have beat around that one, but haven't asked it directly.
You know, not directly, unless there's genital warts that you're noticing. Okay. Would you know really if you're infected?
Okay. All right. So we've kind of implied that maybe is that these viruses are a common cause or are the cause of most common warts, so that some genital warts may be spread by these HPV subtypes. Is it true that if you just have genital warts, that doesn't necessarily mean you're at increased risk of cervical cancer?
So the genital warts are thought to be caused by the low-risk types of virus, not the 16 and 18 that you mentioned. So if you have genital warts, it doesn't necessarily mean you're at increased risk for cervical cancer, but maybe that you've been exposed to some of these lower risk types, so to speak.
Okay. And I always like to ask, what's the natural history of cancer? Of cervical cancer. You've already kind of implied that. Do you mind sharing that again? If a woman is developing cervical cancer, what happens over time if it's not addressed?
Well, we think that if you've been exposed to the higher risk types, that the natural history is 10 years before you would have overt cervical cancer is what the thought is.
All right. For the vast majority of women, that would be the case. There mm-hmm. might be some women that's more aggressive.
Definitely. Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. So now we have somebody who is diagnosed with cervical cancer one way or the other. What are the treatment options? How do you make those treatment decisions, and how do you discuss the options with the individual?
So making the diagnosis is probably the most important to be able to get women to the right the right stage in treatment. So a lot, you know, it starts with screening with the pap smear and the HPV typing, and then colposcopy, which may lead to larger biopsies such as a leap biopsy or what we call a cone biopsy. Depending on what that shows, if we're seeing cancer in situ or overt cancer, then that would be a referral to a gyn oncologist, someone that specializes in women's cancer. So then they would either discuss options such as a hysterectomy or removal of the uterus or radiation treatment, etc.
How about success with the treatment? A number that I put down earlier was that the mortality trends from the same time period we talked about the incidence from 2003 to 2012 has decreased by, again, about 1% per year in women in the United States mortality. Now, so treatment options have been more successful and less uncomfortable. I'm searching for the words. Is that fair to say? I don't know how long you've been seeing women with cervical cancer, but can you?
Well, I've been out of training for 6 years. So, but when I see women, I'm screening and doing some of the prevention aspect. But once the women are diagnosed with cervical cancer and have that diagnosis, then they go on to see a specialist, gynecologist. Mm-hmm. But when we are able to see women early in the process with screening, we can prevent that by doing lower risk procedures like a cervical biopsy, like a LEAP or a cone biopsy, which can prevent them from progressing to overt cervical cancer. And that would be where we can make the most, I think, difference in women's care.
Anything else we need to talk about as far as treatment are pap smears? We've mentioned the age. At a certain age, you can stop getting them. Even if you've gotten the HPV vaccine, it's recommended to continue to get some pap smears. Just looking for issues that people may be thinking about out there. Does that ring any bells for anybody? One other thought that I had is that it may be worth mentioning that HPV, the primary reason for the vaccine is prevention of cervical cancer. However, there are other cancers that are very much associated with HPV infection. It's just that is not the principal or proven reason for the vaccine yet, but we know other cancers are associated with HPV.
Right. When you brought up the question of, the symptoms, I immediately thought of head and neck. And I know we're here to talk about cervical, but that's a huge, what some doctors are considering an epidemic in middle-aged men.
Yeah. We're not hearing enough about that. I tell my patients that as a pediatrician all the time. It's not just cervical cancer. It's vaginal cancer. It's vulvar cancers, it's rectal cancers, and it's head and neck cancers that are significantly being increased and being associated with HPV infections. And theoretically, although I can't say this for sure, should be able to be prevented just as well.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
That's one of the main priorities with the American Cancer Society is just having this looked at as vaccination for boys and girls. It's something I felt like I needed to mention before getting off the line anyways.
Sure.
It is so important.
Yeah, it was a big issue is when the first came out, the mothers would say, well, how come just the girls are getting the vaccine? And I had to remind them that the girls don't get it walking down the street.
Yeah.
We've still got some time. We've got about 5 or 6 minutes. If you've got questions or comments that you would like to try to have answered, our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Both of you are talking with patients that are at risk. Both of you are trying to prevent this kind of disease. What is the resistance? What is the complaints? What is the reasons people are telling you that they are hesitant to get the vaccine?
Well, I don't know. Abby could talk more about some of the hesitancy, but when I see women that are affected, I'm seeing abnormal pap smears and women hesitant to come in for treatment, whether that be a colposcopy or a larger biopsy like a LEAP or a cone biopsy. And I think people are scared. I think it can be very uncomfortable. And it's when you have that, diagnosis, I think it can be scary and you don't really want to deal with it. And so I see women that have an abnormal pap smear and they don't want to come in for their follow-up colposcopies. And I think that can be challenging. And just trying to reassure women and get them in and talk to them about the time frame that we have, and it's likely that it's not cancer, and we can prevent it from becoming cancer. And I think that's important to give them that information.
And as far as hesitancy, I think just going back to that sexual connotation, it's unnerving for parents to have those conversations at 9, 10, 11. But I think also there's, you know, from what I understand, there's some fear of just getting too many vaccines at once. And mm-hmm. that's something that the American Cancer Society really pushes as far as provider education, is this bundling. Mm-hmm. So really not necessarily highlighting the vaccine. When you bring it up and ask if there are concerns, then wait, should I be concerned? So I think that there's just a lot of concern. Are we giving our kids too many vaccines? And research is showing that there isn't a negative impact by bundling. And, mm-hmm. and really, as a pediatrician, the fewer the appointments, the more compliance. Right. So if we can get them on that two-shot series at the right time, right. that's one less appointment that these parents are going to have to take off right. work or whatever to get their patient or their child in there. So
there's two common, well-substantiated reasons why we are not doing too much with vaccines. People think that we're getting more. One is when you give somebody a vaccine, you're introducing a foreign substance, and the amount of total foreign substances, proteins in this case, given with all the vaccines now is less than what I got when I got my first polio vaccines and so forth, because we're much purer. That's one yeah. answer. And two, if you stop and think about it, we are covered with bacteria and fungi and viruses. Our intestinal tract has more bacteria, whole organisms, bacteria, than we have cells in our body. Our immune system is not overwhelmed by 10 or 12 or 14 or 20 vaccines. It's not making sense to listen to that. And I won't get into it, but we're really evolved to respond emotionally rather than with reason. And a lot of these issues involve deep emotions in our brains, and that leads us to make some significant mistakes about protecting ourselves sometimes. But I don't want to get into that too much. It's a whole other program. Ivana, you're on line one if you're still there. Ivana, can we help you?
Sure. I was just wondering, I have a 2-year-old daughter, and yep. I am paranoid about sexual assault. Okay. And I'm wondering, how young is too young? Can I give her it yeah. as soon as possible?
Yeah. So my answer is, we don't have evidence right now that it's safe and effective. However, I'd also say I have very little reason to think it would not be safe and effective. But we really would need to have a long-term study. We need to give kids a younger age and follow them and see if they've developed in a significant immune response that stays long enough. So right now, it would not, I don't think it would be harmful, but we could not give you much guarantee that we have evidence that it would continue to be protective.
So, what age do you have that?
Yeah,
how young can I give it to her?
Yeah, 9, 10, 11, 12.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. Let's see, I think we have time for maybe one more call. Marcy, you're on line one.
Hi, my understanding is that this is exclusively sexually transmitted. Is that right?
Yeah, but you, I mean, it's close personal contact, and I think you could argue, what do you mean by sexual activity, sexual contact?
My question actually was about, you just made the comment that girls don't get it walking down the street. My understanding is that boys don't either, so why would we not vaccinate the boys?
Although the boys are being vaccinated currently. Initially,
what did you mean by that comment?
Initially, when the vaccine came out, it was only recommended for girls because we only had evidence that it was safe and effective in girls, even though we knew it was sexually transmitted. Once it became clear that it was safe and effective in boys, we do boys and girls exactly at the same age and exactly the same push. So,
okay.
So yeah, and I was a little flippant by saying you don't get it walking down the street. It does take some kind of physical contact
for boys and girls.
For our boys and girls, that's true.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thanks for making me more specific, Marcy. But I think it was maybe confusing. Mm-hmm. So we're sitting here at a couple of minutes before the end of the program, and I often like to end by getting my guests to say, what's the most important lessons we want, our messages maybe is the right answer, we want our listeners to take away from today? Abby, let's start with you.
I'll go ahead and say the HPV vaccination is cancer prevention. It's safe. It's for boys and girls, and it's recommended ages 11 and 12. If you can take that away, that'd be good.
Yeah, that's, I think, a very important message, that we are now beginning to be able to prevent cancers as well as treat them much more effectively.
I would say the same, and also screening. Make sure you're getting your pap smear starting at age 21. And if you have been diagnosed with having high-risk HPV types, and if you're a smoker, try to stop smoking. That would be the key.
Do condoms prevent the transmission of HPV infections?
They can, but I don't think, again, they're 100%.
Right.
So.
Right. So it is helpful to decrease the number of episodes of sexual intercourse, number of partners, I should have said, using condoms, smoking. If you have other immune deficiency-related problems, that increases your risk of all viral infections, perhaps getting out of hand, so particularly in individuals who may have HIV or similar immune-affecting illnesses, they need to be a little bit more careful.
Yeah, and I guess I didn't speak about this, but HIV is a little bit different. We treat that a little different, and patients that have HIV are being screened earlier and more frequently.
All right. Well, thanks very much to both of you for coming today. It's been enjoyable. Hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have.
Thanks for having
me.
Thank you. Yeah. So our thanks to Abby Strufford again. She's with the American Cancer Society, and Dr. Shiloh Small. She's an OBGYN specialist with South Central Foundation. If you want to continue this discussion on cervical cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link on our website, www.alaskapublic.org. where you can also find today's program, and we have some links to more information about HPV and cervical cancer, as well as some videos of some women who have survived cervical cancer. And you can also, at that same location with our Line 1 site, give us your thoughts and suggestions for more other programs. Next week, my co-host, Prentice Pimpernan, is going to return, and he's going to be addressing this issue of many teens who may not be successful in school. That can affect their self-esteem. And efforts are being made to address those individuals who may want to or need to address education in a slightly different way than traditional programs, or really are looking for more technical curriculums and so forth. And he will be discussing this with the King Career Center principal, and will be mentioning some new programs that are available for individuals who, as I said, are not maybe feeling so successful with the traditional curriculum. Dave Waldron was today's audio engineer. Eric Bork is our web editor. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.